Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today we'll have a full show. I'm speaking with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, Bipartisan Policy Center's Director of Economic Policy, Shai Akabas, and Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, Ben Ritz. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Treasury has released the official tally for the fiscal year 2018 budget deficit, which ended September 30th. That deficit was $779 billion, the highest since it hit over $1 trillion during the Great Recession. This is a large increase from fiscal year 2017's $666 billion deficit and lends credence to the Congressional Budget Office's projections that show trillion-dollar deficits returning by 2020. Tax cuts and extra discretionary spending for defense as well as non-defense can be blamed for some of the increase in the past year's deficit. The remainder coincides with rising costs for mandatory spending and increasing interest payments on our $21.6 trillion national debt. In fact, no major spending program saw a double-digit percentage increase in the fiscal year. None, that is, except the fastest-growing piece of the federal budget pie, interest payments on the debt. Interest costs rose by 23.6% to $324.7 billion. In fiscal year 2020, the federal government is projected to spend more on interest than the $417 billion it'll spend on Medicaid. And by 2023, it will spend more on interest than it will spend on the military, projected to exceed $700 billion. Congressional leaders have until December 7th to finalize the remaining appropriations bills, or they risk at least a partial government shutdown. That could prove difficult as partisan battles over immigration policy and the president's proposed border wall continue. While the House may be able to push bills through without Democratic buy-in, bills in the Senate will need bipartisan approval. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Bipartisan Policy Center's Director of Economic Policy, Shai Akabas, will join me to discuss BPC's Funding Our Future initiative, as well as the Domenici-Rivlin Debt Reduction Task Force. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Bipartisan Policy Center's Director of Economic Policy, Shai Akabas. Shai has conducted research on a variety of economic policy issues, including the federal budget, retirement security, and the financing of higher education. He joined BPC in 2010 and staffed the Domenici-Rivlin Debt Reduction Task Force. He also assisted Federal Reserve Chairman Powell in his work on the federal debt limit, and he steered BPC's Commission on Retirement Security and Personal Savings. Shai received his bachelor's in economics and history from Cornell and a master's in applied economics from Georgetown. Of course, you all know Bob. He's a regular contributor on the show and fiscal policy expert. Thank you both for joining Facing the Future today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here with Bob, who was one of the first people I met when I came to D.C.
I wanted to talk about a couple BPC initiatives with you today, Shai. One of them I felt was pretty in keeping with what the purpose of Facing the Future is, and that was Funding Our Future, which is a campaign for America's retirement security that BPC is working on. I wondered if you could maybe give a quick description of what prompted that initiative and what it's trying to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. So most people recognize the fact that we have a major retirement security challenge in America today. People are living longer, and it's getting more and more difficult to save for retirement because wages have not been keeping up with costs for various economic necessities like healthcare or education. And with increasing life expectancies, there are more and more years in retirement that people have to fund. So, for example, I personally have several grandparents who are living into their early 90s. And that means when people live to that age, there could be 30 years that they have to figure out how to pay for in retirement if people are claiming Social Security and retiring at age 62, which is the earliest age that they can claim, which in and of itself is often a problem because they have lower Social Security benefits when they do that. But when people do that, they can have 30 years that they have to fund, and saving up enough to supplement their Social Security is really a challenge. On top of that, we have the financial challenges facing Social Security itself. It has been the pillar of retirement security for decades, ever since it was put into place by President FDR. But right now, it's facing serious financial difficulties with the trust fund that it depends on scheduled to be depleted in 2034, just about 15 years from now. And when that happens, everybody who is receiving benefits from the program will get a 23% cut in those monthly benefits. So in addition to the fact that we have this underlying challenge of people accumulating enough savings for retirement, the program that so many Americans rely on, it's something like 60 million Americans rely on for retirement security, is facing these serious challenges.
And before we dive much deeper into that, Shai, are you looking at promoting reform activity? Are you looking at getting citizens engaged and involved and educated? What are the ultimate goals here on funding our future?
A little bit of both. We have so many public policy issues that are taking up the bandwidth on cable news right now, and trying to get attention to an issue like retirement security that is so important for the country moving forward is really difficult. So what we are doing with this Funding Our Future campaign that we started, just kicked off over the summer, is bringing together a coalition of partner organizations. Concord Coalition is among them. We have about 30 plus partners already signed on in just the first several months of the initiative. And we are trying to engage the public to tell their policymakers that this is an important issue that needs to be addressed, both the Social Security side of it and the personal savings side. We have three primary pillars for the campaign, which are to make savings easier at all ages, make saving easier at all ages, help people transform their nest eggs into a lifetime of income, how they make that last in their retirement, and saving Social Security, the third. All of the organizations that we brought together think that those are three important issues that we need to address. Many of them have different solutions that they would propose on their own to how we address them. But what we can all unite around is that we need to find solutions to these challenges and get policymakers to address them sooner rather than later, before the next generation gets into retirement with insufficient savings and with a Social Security program that is on the brink of a financial disaster.
And Shai, you mentioned those three key pillars, and they're very broad sweeping. What are some of the activities you've already started to engage in? Are you looking to have a final report, you know, at some point down the road as a result of this initiative?
The initiative itself isn't developing specific solutions. We are highlighting a bunch of the solutions are out there to show the public that we don't just need to throw up our hands when we're talking about these challenges. We need to look at the solutions and figure out which ones make sense and then enact them. We at BPC, separate and apart from the campaign, had a commission, as you mentioned, on retirement security and personal savings. It was led by former Senator Kent Conrad and Jim Lockhart, who was a senior official in the Bush administration. And they led a group that came together around a series of solutions for Social Security and the other elements of savings and retirement security. We continue to advocate for those as the Bipartisan Policy Center. The campaign itself, though, is going to be more about educating the public about the challenges that we've discussed and the solution set that's available. We've already started doing this and engaging members of Congress in that discussion. So we had a kickoff over the summer in Washington, D.C., where we had Senator Todd Young give some of his thoughts on retirement security and Social Security. We also had a large public event up on Capitol Hill where Hill staffers, mostly younger Hill staffers, came to find out not only about the public policy solutions to the retirement security challenge, but also about what they should be thinking about for their own retirement security, because it is really a complex subject for people in their own personal lives. in terms of how they both make ends meet on a day-to-day basis, save for other priorities, pay off their debts, student loan, credit card, mortgages, and also manage to accumulate enough savings for later in life when they're no longer earning a sustained income. So this type of educational effort and engagement effort is what we plan to continue with all of our partners in the months ahead.
Before I kick this over to Bob, because I'm sure he's got burning questions as well, and I want to dig deeper, but I had sort of this higher level question. I know you're not pushing for specific reforms with this initiative, but as it pertains to retirement security and the current divided Congress, do you see we're at a point now or in the near future where we can achieve some kind of bipartisan, realistic reforms on some of these challenges?
So it's interesting you ask that right now, because there is, in fact, legislation moving through Congress, if you can believe it, on retirement security. It's not the top of the headlines, but there are serious proposals that are bipartisan that would address some of the challenges, particularly on the personal savings and 401k side of the problem. And these aren't massive overhauls of the system that we have today, but they are important adjustments to the system that would make it easier for people to save, make it easier for employers to offer their employees good savings plans, because we know that savings plans through the workplace, 401k type plans, are where people accumulate most of their retirement assets. And if this legislation were to pass, which could happen either later this year or next year if there isn't time at the end of this year, it could make us move the ball forward in a significant way. Now, it does not address the biggest elephant in the room, which is Social Security, or the fundamental challenges that many, many people are running out of money in retirement with no recourse. But it will help pave the road for future generations to be more prepared. So it's the start of a solution, not the end of working on this. But I'm encouraged by the fact that our policymakers are at least under the headlines, paying some attention to this issue and starting to get the ball rolling.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Bipartisan Policy Center's Director of Economic Policy, Shai Acabas. And Bob, I've been dominating most of this conversation, so it's certainly a good time, I think, for you to jump in here with a question.
Well, that's as per usual, Chase. That's
par for the course on Facing the Future.
Par for the course. I really like the idea of this as a retirement security issue, because there are so many aspects of it, and too often, I think the debate in Washington or among policy experts focuses just on Social Security, which you can do because it's got a dedicated revenue stream and benefits stream, and it's easier to sort of isolate it. But, I mean, what does it exist for? It exists for retirement security, and that encompasses more than just Social Security. You know, one of the things that I've been intrigued with is that people have incentives for savings that they don't take advantage of. What about the idea of having an automatic mandatory participation that you can opt out of? Is that a viable option?
Yeah. So, in fact, a lot of other countries have gone to that approach where there is a requirement to be automatically enrolled in something, in an account where you can accumulate savings. But then people have the opportunity to decide that's not their priority and not contribute to those accounts. We in the U.S. obviously have a voluntary system where people make the decision on their own. Certain employers do offer their employees accounts and do it with automatic enrollment, which means that the employee is automatically contributing to the account out of their own money unless they decide not to. And I think we're seeing more and more of that over time. To get to a point where everybody is required to be offering an account, that gets into trickier political territory, because the environment around requirements is obviously a delicate one.
Kidding.
An understatement. My sense, though, is that the first step is we need to make it much easier for employers to offer their employees these accounts. The burdens right now on particularly small businesses that have 10 employees, a zero-person HR shop, they don't even have there's such a small operation that they don't have a person who's dedicated to that. And then having them need to go through all the paperwork and all the research that is involved with figuring out what type of plan to offer their employees and what the different aspects of it should be is really far too challenging. So what we need to do from a public policy perspective is make that much, much simpler. And once that's done, then we can talk about having employers required to offer something to their employees. If the burden on the employer is really minimal, I think that overcomes a lot of the opposition that you see today, where small business owners are rightfully saying, we're focused on running our business. To have us divert our attention to running a retirement plan is not the right thing for us. And I think that's the needle that we need to thread over time. And there are several steps between here and there. Ultimately, I think that's the direction we might end up going.
So there are two choices. One is whether the employer wants to offer a retirement plan, which is really up to the employer. And then second, if they do, whether it should be a mandatory system or an opt-out. I don't know that this is true, but the people that could most use the savings incentives are the people that most need it. Whereas if you got people that would save anyway, who don't need the incentive, but their employers might be in a better position to provide it. So it is a difficult policy quandary, I would think, for employers.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at small businesses in particular, so under 50 employees, less than half of them offer a 401k type account to their employees. And those employees tend to be more often part-time employees, lower-income employees, minorities, all sort of populations that we would be concerned to not have that opportunity to accumulate savings for later in life. So public policy, I think, needs to focus on those populations.
One of the other things I always looked at just as a federal budget issue is that savings incentives provided through the federal budget. There's a concern that I've always had, I think, is do they really incentivize savings or do they just give money to people who are going to save anyway? So in other words, it becomes a government giveaway and it doesn't really achieve the objective, but it affects the government's bottom line. Have you looked at that sort of a trade-off?
Yeah, so there's a lot of discussion on both sides of that issue. What I do think there's consensus around, however, is that at the very top and at the bottom end, there are some problems with the current system. At the very top, we have people using these types of accounts as effectively tax shelters. So they get to shelter the money from government revenues, and the government's not collecting that money. And they get rewarded on an ongoing basis for that. So you have the example of Mitt Romney's Roth IRA, which means you pay taxes before on the money you put in. The money explodes because you put it into something that was not a stock type of account that was not yet public. It goes public and the money is all of a sudden worth millions of dollars. So cutting off loopholes like that is really important at the top end and limiting the amount that people can save in those accounts. When you have $5, $10 million, people don't need to accumulate more than that in a tax-favored account. At the other end, we have the issue that the current preferences don't really benefit people who are paying little or no federal income taxes, because the way that the preference works is by lowering your tax liability. If you owe little or no taxes, that's not much of a benefit. So we need to find new ways with something like a credit or a direct match from the government, where if you're very low income or modest income, you're earning, say, $20,000, $25,000 a year, and you put away $500 in your account, there should be a more direct incentive for you where the government will match that $500 in your retirement savings account. That would be a much more understandable way and a more effective way to help that part of the population that has the most difficulty saving for their later years.
And Shai, all of this sort of prompts the question for me. We're talking about how employees and employers might handle these systems and incentives differently. Have you noticed any difference generationally in terms of perspective on planning for retirement or perspective on retirement security programs like Social Security?
Definitely. And there are statistics out there. Nearly 30% of Americans between the ages of 30 and 39, so sort of the millennial or just in front of the millennial generation, have nothing accumulated in retirement savings. That's really disconcerting. Additionally, a lot of those same Americans, those younger generations, don't think that Social Security is going to pay them anything when they get to retirement. So there's a lack of confidence in the programs that are there today. Gallup did a recent poll that found 51% of working age Americans didn't think they were going to ever receive a penny from Social Security. It's hard to convince people that this is a real problem that needs to be tackled from a policy perspective when they're already saying that they don't believe the program is going to be there for them. And whether they actually believe this or not, it just shows a disillusionment with the entire system in terms of government and reliance on it. So I think we need to come up with policy solutions that are focused on those younger Americans, especially those that have large burdens of student debt, which are greater than prior generations coming out of their post-secondary education. And it's a complicated problem that's going to require several different types of solutions.
I think the Funding Our Future initiative, its importance is emphasized by what you just explained, which to me indicates sort of a fundamental lack of understanding of how the Social Security system even works. Even if millennials think the program won't exist when we go to retire, we're still going to be paying into it all of our lives to support current beneficiaries. I wanted to get to...
And we thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're very welcome, Bob. But we're running... We've only got a couple minutes left, and I did want to touch on something that you, both Bob and Shai, served on together, or at least participated in together, and that was the Domenici Rivlin Debt Reduction Task Force. Shai, maybe give a quick 30,000-foot view of what that task force was meant to do, and then Bob, maybe you can talk a little bit about what it potentially achieved in terms of putting a map out there on how we can tackle some of these challenges.
Absolutely. I came to Washington back in 2010, and that was the height of the concern around the federal debt and deficits. It was right after the Great Recession, where a lot of spending programs have been put into place and tax breaks to help offset some of the worst effects of that economic downturn. And as a result, we had ballooned the federal debt. Policymakers were turning their attention to this issue, and there weren't a whole lot of solution sets out there. So the Bipartisan Policy Center set up a task force that was led by Alice Rivlin, who was President Clinton's budget director, and the late Senator Pete Domenici, who was the former chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. And the two of them gathered together a group of individuals that Bob was a distinguished member of, and they came up with a plan to address our debt and deficit challenges that we faced in the future. These are long-term problems. These are not problems that could be solved in a couple years, but they require solutions that are put in place over a period of time that can be phased in, especially for programs like Social Security and Medicare that have millions and millions of people that are receiving benefits today, and will need to make sure that people anticipate changes that are coming to those programs. So they put out that comprehensive report in 2010. It was actually alongside and contributed to the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which people might remember President Obama put together, that was under the leadership of Alan Simpson, a former senator, and Erskine Bowles. And the two of them had an official commission that the government had set up. Our task force that Bob was on sort of fed into that commission, and the solution sets were fairly similar, which I think goes to show that there is a fair amount of bipartisan consensus on what we can do around these challenges. Unfortunately, and Bob can speak a little bit more to this, there have not been serious steps to tackle them today, and we're in an even worse position than we were 8 years ago, even though the headlines aren't necessarily reflecting that.
Yeah, I think that the dynamic was very interesting in that it was a thoroughly bipartisan commission, and people went into it with the idea that there would have to be compromises, that if you started taking your own priorities off the table, no agreement would ever be reached on something this large. And so there was that cooperation, which you really don't have that environment right now. But I think it does go to the fact that you can't solve the problem otherwise. And Shai mentioned that we came to very similar conclusions from the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which is really interesting because there wasn't coordination between the two. Alice Rivlin was the only one who was a member of both. We both looked at the tax code and said that you could get new revenues by eliminating or scaling back so-called tax expenditures, simplifying the code, making it more economically efficient, and you could lower rates, but still bring in more revenue that way. And we obviously looked at the major entitlement programs, but we looked at them, I think, in a holistic way, as we were talking about before, particularly on healthcare. We looked at things that would not just address Medicare or Medicaid specifically, but that would try to make the delivery of healthcare more efficient, but more effective. There's a lot of waste, and I don't mean that in the trivial sense. Treatments that don't work, or over treatments, or the so-called fee for service system, where it incentivizes doctors and providers to provide more rather than to provide a more efficient and higher quality service. And we phased things in because at that point we were still coming out of a very deep recession. So we realized that a deficit reduction task force shouldn't come in all at once and say we have to start implementing austerity at this point because that wasn't our purpose and that wasn't the point we were trying to get across. We were trying to get across that we needed to get a sustainable fiscal situation, not start chopping things or raising taxes suddenly. And I think we achieved that. But the moment didn't take politically, and now we have to wait for it to come around again. And when it does come around, you have to look at the way that we approach the task in a bipartisan way and the way that you just kind of put everything on the table and realize you're going to have to make some difficult choices on mandatory spending and revenues.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Bipartisan Policy Center Director of Economic Policy, Shai Acabas. We were discussing what BPC is currently working on, the Funding Our Future initiative, as well as what Bob and Shai worked on together in the Domenici-Rivlin Debt Reduction Task Force. I wish we could have spent a lot more time talking about those things, but I really appreciate you both being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Chase.
Thanks, Chase.
Up next, Bob Bixby will be back, and Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, Ben Ritz, will join us. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, Ben Ritz. Ben previously staffed the Bipartisan Policy Center's Commission on Retirement Security and Personal Savings and worked on other federal budget issues at BPC. He also used to work for the Concord Coalition, so he's one of my former colleagues, and Ben has a master's degree from American University. Bob, welcome back, and Ben, welcome for the first time.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you, Chase.
Happy to have you on the show in your new capacity working for the Progressive Policy Institute. And you guys just put out a report that I think you personally wrote. So it's hot off the presses. It's called Defunding America's Future, The Squeeze on Public Investment in the United States. And I want to talk a lot about that with you here today. So maybe before we dive into the nitty-gritty, give maybe a high-level summary of the purpose and findings of the report for us, Ben.
So a lot of times when people talk about the debt and the deficit, there's a lot of focus on the problems with debt, but not so much the impact that rising debt can have on other budget priorities. One of the reasons that we think Democrats don't pay a lot of attention to debt and deficits so much right now is because there are a lot of things they want to spend money on, which are good progressive objectives. But the larger the debt gets, the more interest we have to pay on that debt. And that is crowding out a lot of really important public investments. And so we thought, number one, this is a good opportunity, what with the Trump administration really increasing the deficit substantially in the first 2 years in office. This is a good time for Democrats to push back and offer a more progressive approach that both funds important public investments and controls the growth of debt. And we just wanted to make it clear to Democrats that there is a way to do this, to achieve their goals and be fiscally responsible.
And I guess I should put a disclaimer on here, since Concord and our radio show, Facing the Futures, intended to be nonpartisan, that Ben's role is a little more Democratic than it used to be. So you'll probably hear a lot of references to Democratic Party perspectives and positions and perhaps priorities. Getting into that a little bit, Ben, you mentioned the impact rising debt can have on other priorities. What were some of the priorities that you identified in the report and the impact rising debt is having on them?
The big priorities that we were looking at are public investments. And the three things that are categorized as public investment is research and development, which builds our intellectual capital, physical capital investments, which are infrastructure and other government assets, and then education and training, which builds our human capital. And so we looked at how that has changed in recent years as mandatory spending has grown and revenues have not really. What we've seen with these public investments over the past several years, between 1965 and 1980, total federal spending on public investment was roughly about 2.5% of GDP, but it's fallen significantly in recent years, and now it's less than 1.5% of GDP. So that's a pretty significant drop. And on our current trajectory, it's projected to fall to its lowest level in modern history since World War II. And the other thing to note is that education is the only category of public investment that has actually grown slightly, and that if you take that out, public spending on infrastructure and R&D together is half of what it used to be during the 60s through the 80s. So these are serious, large drops in spending on these categories that can have long-term implications for the economy. And we wanted to draw attention to the problems with that being crowded out.
So, Ben, just jumping off the term crowding out there, can you break down, and Bob, this might be a good topic for you to jump in on here, but Ben, can you break down a little bit what you mean by crowding out? What is causing the crowding out? Why can't the government just decide to spend more on these particular investments?
So when I say crowding out, I'm talking about the fact that while the cost of these programs are falling, the cost of other programs are rising, mainly programs like Social Security, Medicare, other healthcare programs. These programs are growing significantly. In addition, because we keep running deficits and racking up debt, the interest costs on that debt are also growing. So whereas total spending on public investments now is about 7 to 8% of federal spending, we project that it's going to fall to half that level within the next 30 years or so.
And Ben, it seems to me that there's kind of a reinforcing effect here that as some programs like Social Security or Medicare, the so-called major entitlement programs, get more expensive because of the aging of the population, we're doing less to invest in the economy that is going to have to produce the goods and services and the benefits for these aging baby boomers like me. So if the government is going to have to grow the economy in the future, it should be doing more to invest in that future. And it seems to me what your report is getting at is that we're going in the wrong direction.
Right, exactly. So what we're seeing is the government is spending more money paying for past promises, both in the forms of those programs you mentioned and interest costs on the debt. And meanwhile, we are cutting investments in future generations. One big part of that is economic growth, but there's also a big important question about intergenerational equity. So we saw the baby boomers, they put in place policies to give themselves health care and retirement benefits that they didn't really pay for because they were simultaneously cutting their own taxes and cutting investments in future generations. So young Americans today and their children and grandchildren are going to have to grapple with the fact that the previous generation both saddled them with a lot of debt and unfunded obligations, while at the same time cutting investments in their future that had been around for baby boomers when they were of a similar age.
And I noticed that you are coming from this, from the Progressive Policy Institute, not the Concord Coalition, or the Bipartisan Policy Center where you used to work. So it is making a case to progressives and to Democrats why they should worry not just about the lack of investments, but the rest of the federal budget, because you need to have the resources available to make these investments. So let's talk a little bit about that, why it's a progressive agenda.
Bob, sorry to cut you off there, but just before Ben answers that question, I wanted to remind our listeners who we're talking to. This is Facing the Future, and I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, as well as the Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, Ben Ritz. We're talking about PPI's report that just came out, Defunding America's Future. And Ben, I'll hand it back over to you, but I just wanted to take that quick little break there to remind our listeners of who we're talking to and what we're talking about.
Sure, no problem. So to answer Bob's question, the reason we think this is an important part of the progressive agenda is there's a few reasons. First of all, progressives believe that government can do things to help people and make our lives and our economy stronger. And it's very difficult to do that when you're allowing these programs to grow on autopilot, the big social insurance programs to grow on autopilot, and while you're cutting all these other functions of government. And so we think it's important to protect those other functions of government that serve a lot of progressive ends. And we'll actually have a second report coming out a little bit more about how those programs serve progressive goals in the near future. But the other element of it is, frankly, there's something to be said for showing that government can work. When we show that, when progressives show that they can have both ambitious social policies and pay for them, that gives people a lot more trust in government's ability to do things right. Whereas when it's racking up a lot of debt and deficits, that creates an image of a government that is living beyond its means. And as a result, it will be more difficult to get voters to support these expansions of important programs.
And Ben, you mentioned earlier in the show some of the existing policies that are impacting these issues and helping continue sort of the crowding out of important investment areas. And I know the report talks to some of those current policies and current law. Can you break down a little bit some of those current policies that are having such an impact? And I think you even talked a little bit about alternative scenarios. So a lot of these projections and issues are based on existing law, but there's sort of this public policy agenda out there that might result in changes to that law, and what trends are you seeing there?
We look at two different baselines, and we focus a little more on the second one. The first baseline is the current law baseline that the Congressional Budget Office uses, and that basically assumes that if the laws remain as currently written, that is what the future budget will look like. And so if something is scheduled to expire, even for arbitrary reasons, it is assumed to expire in the current law baseline. The current policy baseline shows what would happen if we instead made all of the policies that are in place now permanent and continued them into the future. And so the reason why that's a big deal is that you have things like the Trump tax cuts that significantly reduce revenue over the next several years. But then in 2025, a lot of those tax cuts are set to expire. And the reality that we saw with the Bush tax cuts is that the vast majority of them ended up being made permanent. And so we think that it's important to be clear-eyed about the impact of these policies that we're setting up now rather than relying on arbitrary expirations to make the budget picture look better. The last thing I'll say on that is that it's not like the current law baseline is particularly good either. The current law baseline shows us growing to about 150-some percent of GDP over the next 30 years. And the current policy baseline shows that we will grow to over 200%, that will grow to over 200% of GDP in the next 30 years. And so either of those are significant levels of debt, but the alternatives to the current policy scenario is even worse.
And just to push back a little bit there, Ben, to keep this as nonpartisan as possible, you mentioned the Trump and Republican tax cuts reducing revenue, even though we're seeing economic growth of 3 to 4% in the short term here. What are you relying upon to take the long view of we're actually still going to see a reduction in revenue, even with the spike in economic growth? As many other pundits might say, you know, this economic growth is good, it'll result in more revenue, and so on.
People who say that economic growth is going to make up for the lost revenue from the tax cuts are just plain wrong. Larry Kudlow said this recently, and all the fact checkers pointed out that it was completely incorrect. So even with the tax cuts in place and larger economic growth, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that because these are deficit-fueled tax cuts, the growth of debt and the crowding out of available resources because of that debt is going to outweigh the benefit that we get from the tax cuts. And so what you see right now is a period of temporary supercharged growth, like a sugar high, and the problem is that eventually that's going to go away, whether it's because of debt or because the tax cuts suddenly expire. So either way, you're looking at a situation where it doesn't make sense to focus too much on the current economic growth because it's just temporary and we're likely to pay for it on the back end in the future.
You know, on the question of revenues, you remind me because the Treasury report just came out about the end of fiscal year 2018. And it gets into a confusing debate about the effect of the tax cuts because people look at the year-end revenue number and people in the administration are saying, well, look, revenue went up from 2017 to 2018, which it did. And I can see on a mathematical level, people will look at that and say, well, okay, I mean, you know, we didn't lose revenue. We actually gained revenue. And it gets into this baseline thing because we gain revenue every year. Revenue goes up every year because it naturally grows with the economy, unless you're in a recession. So with a largely growing economy like we had last year, you would expect a much bigger revenue increase than we got. So the fact that the revenues were essentially flat is actually a sign that the tax cuts cost revenue, even though as a talking point, people can say it actually went up a little bit. So it gets to be kind of confusing.
And I completely agree. And just one small thing to add to that. I believe if you factor in just inflation, forgetting about GDP growth, it ends up not to have been that much of a gain at all either.
I think it would probably be a loss if you factor in inflation.
Right. So, you know, not taking into account all the increases in productivity and growing population, that would automatically lead tax revenues to go up. Just because of inflation alone, it is going down. So it's very clear that revenue is not continuing to keep track with where we would have expected it to go had the tax cuts not passed.
So, Ben, unfortunately, we are running short on time. This will probably have to be our last question. I know this is a really thick report. I'd love to spend more time diving into it. It's like 40-plus pages. So my last question for you, Ben, looking ahead at the report, you talk a lot about some of the sort of short-sighted policies that might be shortchanging young Americans. So I wanted to know if you could give a real quick top few takeaways there on, you know, how these issues are impacting current and future generations, and maybe some key first steps to sort of turn the tide on what's transpiring.
So when we say short-sighted policies or shortchanging future generations, we're really referring to two things. The current generation, you know, cutting taxes and allowing spending to grow significantly on autopilot, and so saddling future generations with more debt. And then the other thing is the decision to, instead of dealing with these problems, cut public investments such as R&D, infrastructure, education, that really do benefit future generations. And so the combination of giving them the burden of unfunded obligations and higher debt while simultaneously cutting investments in their future is really putting a big squeeze on future generations. As far as how we might tackle that, I think the big answer is, you know, we start by repealing the Trump tax cuts, look at alternative new revenue sources, and at the same time, control the growth of these large social insurance programs. And then the last thing would be to also find ways to increase public investment spending so that it is closer to where it was historically.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, Ben Ritz. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thanks, Chase.
Thanks.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Federal budget deficits are increasing at a troubling rate. The Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, during its September monthly budget review, which was the end of the 2018 fiscal year, estimated that the federal deficit for that year would total $782 billion. The Treasury just provided the final tally, $779 billion, which is still an increase of $113 billion over the previous fiscal year. While those numbers are troubling enough, they get even worse when shifts in the timing of some federal payments are taken into account. Were it not for those shifts, CBO says, the 2018 deficit would have actually been $826 billion. Recent deficits have substantially boosted the accumulated federal debt. That debt now totals $21.6 trillion and is expected to continue rising rapidly. Not to mention, CBO has previously warned that annual deficits could top $1 trillion as soon as fiscal year 2020. Existing and proposed policies have not only failed to address the big fiscal challenges facing the country, they have made them worse. And despite the growing economy, federal revenues for fiscal year 2018 stayed relatively flat, totaling $3.3 trillion. Spending totaled $4.12 trillion in fiscal year 2018, up from $3.98 trillion the previous year. Roughly three-quarters of the spending growth came from mandatory spending programs and interest on the debt. The CBO also noted that fiscal year 2018 was the third consecutive year in which the deficit increased as a percentage of GDP.
Another estimate that should alarm both Washington and citizens is a 20% increase or $62 billion increase in interest on the public debt. The government's interest costs in 2018 totaled $325 billion, a figure that is projected to rise rapidly in the coming decade. This increase is partly because of higher interest rates and the rising debt. CBO, the Concord Coalition, and others have frequently warned that rising interest costs will put increasing pressure on the rest of the federal budget, squeezing even high national priorities. The rapidly increasing deficit and debt should be central issues in this fall's elections. Voters should expect congressional incumbents and challengers alike to present credible plans to put the federal budget on a more sustainable path. Otherwise, we will continue to see the crowding out of key areas of investment, a growing debt burden per citizen, and vital programs like Social Security and Medicare put at risk. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.